All right, so middle lecture in our learning and cognition series here. So general announcements, AREC, so the Unit C reading assignment and Canvas activity are due Sunday because we'll end this unit this week. Otherwise, looking forward, this is kind of the timeline. So we've got this week, Unit C. Next week, we start Unit D and we end it the week after that. Then the Thursday of that week will be the midterm review. And then the two stages of the midterm will be the week after that. So we've got just to, again, count this week, next week, the week after that, and then there's the midterm. Again, this is a two-stage midterm. So there'll be a stage one, it'll be an individual. You can take in class or at home. You don't have to come to class, but I'll be here in case you do want to take it here, Canvas-based. So it will be, you'll get 90 minutes from whenever you start it. And you have to end it within that 90 minutes. It looks like nobody's in this class afterwards. So if you do come here, I can probably hang around for that full 90 minutes. If for some reason something does get scheduled, worst comes to worst, you've got at least 75. The 15 is sort of extra for extra like technical difficulties. And then Thursday of that week is the stage two. You don't have to take it as a group, but it will be open and available, no lockdown. It will also be the exact same exam as stage one, but it's open book, open notes, and you can collaborate with anyone currently enrolled in the class, but you don't have to. So again, if you want to come here to collaborate during that day, that's fine. Otherwise, you can take it at home. Both of these exams will be open all day Tuesday and all day Thursday. So for stage two, you can just keep coming back to it all day because it's not timed. So that's kind of the lineup. And as we get a little closer to this week, I can give more details here. But any questions about this timeline moving forward? Yep. It says it shouldn't be on the Canvas calendar. I'd have to count forward. That sounds about right, but don't quote me on that. It should say on the Canvas calendar exactly when these are scheduled. Any other questions? Okay. Yep, sorry. No. So the scores, the answers, your scores of all of that will be hidden from stage one to stage two, but you will be able to use scrap paper on lockdown for stage one. And if you want to record questions that you thought you might be more difficult for you, so you have those notes to bring into stage two, that's totally fine.
Stage two.
So whatever week this was, I think we said maybe October 6th. So nominally stage one, you'll have sort of all day Tuesday to start it and finish it. Same ways with stage two, it'll be all day Thursday to start it and finish it. Now, what I'm probably going to do is actually pop these open so that stage one will be available Monday, Tuesday, Wednesday, and stage two, Thursday, Friday, to provide a little extra flexibility, especially because I think this is the week before fall break. I could be maybe don't quote me on that. But I think part of the reason I did that was to also provide people travel flexibility if they want to knock this thing out and, because you can take it remotely and those sorts of things. So I haven't decided whether I want to do stage one Monday, Tuesday, and stage two Wednesday, Thursday, Friday. But I think usually the student preference ends up being stage one, Monday, Tuesday, Wednesday, and stage two, Thursday, Friday. But if you have strong feelings about that and want to make your argument, let me know. But I'll give you a lot of flexibility that week and when you and the availability dates for these. Other questions? Okay. So last time we talked about basic models of learning, and we're going to use those as lenses today to look at more complex examples of learning that we see in nature. So the basic ones we saw last time were imprinting, non-associative learning, habituation, sensitization, and associative learning or conditioning. So that was your classical conditioning and your operant conditioning. So as a little review from last time, imprinting, that's the one where during a critical period in the lifetime of an animal, then there is a critical feature that cues that animal to learn something that they will learn for the rest of their lives. So the kind of standard example for this is the identity of a parent. When a something that looks, you know, quack, looks like a duck, quacks like a duck, in exactly the right time, then that will be imprinted on the animal as the parent of that animal. And so then that animal will, through its entire development, always know to go back to that parent, and it won't need to be reinforced. So that's the critical thing about imprinting, is that at this special period in life, then you get this lifelong memory. But then after that period, you can't re-imprint. So it's stuck with that. So that's imprinting. And so more modern example of that. So, you know, Wild Robot, which came up, you know, recently suggested that maybe a little duck could, you know, end up imprinting, you know, a duck that was lost, then maybe might take on a robot as its parent and follow it around. So, you know, common, you know, cultural reference to imprinting. So other example, non-associative learning. So here we're not associating a particular piece of information with a behavior necessarily, but we're sort of fine-tuning attention based on likely information present. So habituation is when you have a stimulus, and we're not usually thinking about a static stimulus, like the feeling of the clothes on your skin. This is usually a more dynamic stimulus, like it's a signal, it's the sound of a projector, it's the sound of the highway. If you live by a highway, those sorts of things, these things that potentially could be information bearing, that are dynamic, that you might notice the ebbs and flows of them, but because they don't seem to be associated with anything, then over time, you end up filtering them out. So your central nervous system, so this doesn't happen out at your periphery, this doesn't happen at the level of your skin or your ears, it happens in your brain. Your brain ends up not paying attention to those. So it tunes your attention. But if if that stimulus suddenly changes in a less predictable way or in a surprise way, then you'll get sensitization, you'll refocus attention on it. So the classic example in this sea hare is the sea hare has got a siphon that sticks out of these gills. And if you touch the gills or the siphon at a regular interval, and it's a regular kind of soft interval, then initially it will pull the siphon in and close the gills up. But then over time, it'll open them back up because that it's kind of like the pulsing of the water. It doesn't actually carry any useful information. And so, you know, put the siphon out there because the siphon needs to do its job. But if that ever intensifies, so if you're hitting on this at a particular frequency, and then suddenly you whack on it at a much harder, much more pressure than you had been before, then suddenly it will become resensitized. It will suddenly pull in and start paying attention to that again. So it's a loss of attention or a regaining, a loss of attention or a regaining of attention. So it's an informational filter before you start worrying about associative learning. It's sort of in between your peripheral nervous system and your higher order learning functions. It's kind of in between there, it filters attention. That's what we mean by non-associative learning. Questions about that? Those two terms, do they make sense? Habituation, that's, you know, losing, you know, starting to ignore something, and sensitization, that's starting to pay more attention to it again. Okay, and then the more common ones we hear about, operant conditioning and classical conditioning. So these are both examples of associative learning or conditioning, where an association is made between two stimuli or between an action and a consequence. So the idea here in classical conditioning is that you have an unconditioned stimulus that will trigger an unconditioned response. This is kind of a natural response to a background stimulus. And there is another stimulus that normally doesn't have that response or any response. And by presenting these two stimuli together, then eventually after training, then this response to the original unconditioned stimulus also becomes the response to that new or previously neutral stimulus. And so the previously neutral stimulus we now call the conditioned stimulus. And then the response to the conditioned stimulus we refer to as the conditioned response. But I just want to emphasize, it is the same behavior as the original unconditioned response. It's now triggered by two separate things. It can either be triggered by the original stimulus or by the new stimulus. And that's what we mean by classical conditioning. Questions about that? Sort of psych 101, maybe. So, not necessarily a review of this class, but maybe things that many of you have seen before. And then the other side of that then is operant conditioning. So, B.F. Skinner, a major name in behaviorism, which we're going to talk about the contrast between behaviorism and cognitive science next time. But Skinner thought that classical conditioning wasn't kind of enough to be able to investigate complex behaviors that form in nature. And so Skinner's paradigm was operant conditioning. So the idea was you have an operant, which is a behavior that, or sorry, an operant, which is a behavior that results in a consequence. And so the idea here is that an animal behaves in a particular way and receives feedback from the environment, and that changes the frequency of that operant. And so it might be that that behavior is accidentally emerges spontaneously, and then suddenly a huge reward is felt. And then the animal learns that it should do that behavior more often and get that reward. Or it might accidentally wander into an area that it's never wandered into before, and it gets a huge punishment. It gets a negative experience, and that makes it less likely to do that. So that modification of the frequency of behaviors is what we refer to as operant conditioning. And so the idea here is there's two mechanisms, one that increases frequency and one that decreases frequency. And we're just going to say anything that leads to an increase in frequency is a reinforcer, reinforcement. Anything that leads to a decrease in frequency is a punishment. And that's just our simple definition of what we mean by, that's how we operationalize operant conditioning. Increase in frequency is reinforcement, decrease in punishment. But there's two different ways you can apply reinforcement and punishment. You can either take something away that's always there, or you can add something new that wasn't there before. And so that's where we get this further division of positive and negative stimuli. So either of these, you can have positive reinforcement and negative reinforcement. You can positive punishment, which sounds funny, or negative punishment. And so positive means that you're adding something that wasn't there. And if you add something that wasn't there and that causes an animal to do that behavior more often, it's positive reinforcement. If you add something that wasn't there and that causes an animal to do that behavior less often, it's positive punishment. Likewise, negative reinforcement and negative punishment. So the idea is there, if you take away something which causes the animal to do something more often, so if they're sort of maybe always in an adverse environment and then suddenly it becomes better when, so you took away that whatever that stress was. If you take away that stress on the animal when they do a particular behavior and it makes them do it more often, then because it's doing it more often, that's reinforcement. But because you took it away, it's negative reinforcement versus positive reinforcement. So questions about those categories. So both of these here apply to both of these here. Okay. And then we can, so how do you test these things? Behind this, you can kind of see this is a little translucent. There's a bird in a box. Here is a rat in a box. And so, these are so-called Skinner boxes. The common feature of the laboratory environment gives you a lot of options to apply different types of stimulus that are likely to increase frequencies or decrease frequencies of behavior. You've got, different stimuli that can trigger behaviors. So a lot of different tools that you can use to test learning. And often it's what you're doing is not testing whether an animal can learn. Often you're sort of saying, well, this is an animal in one group and an animal in another group. Let's measure those. Remember, we talked about those learning curves. Let's measure the learning curve in one group versus the learning curve in another group. So if you think that there's a particular neural pathway that's involved in learning, you might be able to genetically alter an animal to not have that pathway. And you can then test, okay, so under our hypothesis that that is a mechanism of learning, since we've removed that mechanism, we should have see a decrease in the ability to learn. So our prediction would be you put them in the scanner or the Skinner box and you see less learning. If you see an equal amount of learning between the group with the normal pathways and the ones with the altered pathways, then that doesn't support your hypothesis that that was the mechanism of learning. So that's usually how we use these sorts of things. The questions about these setups, pretty clear. Again, this is just review. Yes. So there's a hypothesis there so a steep learning curve, so a learning curve where you learn quickly, so there's not many trials are needed in the first couple of trials, then so in the case of an so classical conditioning would be how quickly you make that association. In operant conditioning, it might be how quickly you increase in frequency of the behavior or decrease in frequency of the behavior. So a steep learning curve would be that if an animal shows a steep learning curve, they learn quickly. Now, there's a hypothesis there that if you learn quickly, you might also forget quickly. That isn't necessarily the case, but it might be certain animals that is the case, other animals there isn't the case. So we would look to test for that. So we might put them in a setup like this, see how quickly they learn, take them away from the setup, bring them back to the setup, see if they still remember. And then we'd see, do we see a correlation that ones that learn fast also forget fast? And you could absolutely do that. It's a great question to ask. And if you do find that that's the pattern, then there's all sorts of mechanistic questions about how does that work? Is there, are the pathways for memory the same as the pathways for forgetting? All of this sort of stuff. If they're parallel pathways, then maybe they have different dynamics. Those sorts of things. You can then ask why questions too, like why might it be good to learn something quickly and forget something quickly? Maybe the environment changes so fast that the same pressures to learn things quickly also mean you should forget them quickly because it's going to change and anything you remember from the old environment you need to get rid of. So great questions can stem from that. Any other questions? And then one that I'm not going to worry too much here, but I do want to at least bring it up is that when you're training an animal, you have to think about the ecological relevance of what you're training them to do. So, are they prepared for the task? So, is it relevant to their evolutionary history? So, as you'll see in the reading for this unit, squirrels and we'll talk about it here too. Squirrels can bury, find nuts and bury them places, and then come back to those places and dig them up. So that is a task that squirrels are able to do. So we don't know if that involves memory. That's a hypothesis. But you could generate a task that is analogous to that type of task, and that would be relevant to their evolutionary history. It might be easier to train them along those. But if you come up with a task that is completely irrelevant, then so there was a famous example with honeybees. There was an ophthalmologist in like the 1920s or something like that, and they put honeybees in a box, and then they put blue light and yellow light in corners of the box, and then they wanted to see if you open the corners of the box so they're streaming in at the same time, blue light and yellow light, would the honeybee go to one color or the other? And they found that it was a 50-50 chance. It didn't go to blue or yellow. And so the ophthalmologist who was doing this study on the honeybees, then inferred that honeybees cannot see in color because they did not have a preference for blue or yellow. But then von Frisch, who's the one who discovered the waggle dance, which I think we'll talk about later in the semester, said, well, that's not ecologically relevant. Like, if a bee is trapped in a box, any light is probably a good cue to get out of the box. And so why would you expect that there'd be a preference? So von Frisch then came up with some of these experiments, which now people do to these days, where you come up with little like plastic flowers that are, colored differently. And some, maybe the blue ones were rewarded, and so they had nectar in them. And the yellow ones, these little fake plastic flowers, were not rewarded. And after bees experienced a room full of these things, where the blue ones were always rewarded and the yellow ones weren't, it turns out the bees would just go to blue. So then under that, more ecologically relevant, bees forage on colored flowers. They were prepared for that task. So it was a much more ecologically relevant task. So that's kind of what we mean by prepared or unprepared. And then there's contra-prepared, where you're trying to train an animal to do something. You're training a predator to maybe not eat its prey. You know, that is something that it would be particularly difficult to do. But you know, for different reasons, that might actually be ideal for your study, is that, you know, we want to see how hard it is to, you know, maybe we're studying the effect of, maybe we have a model system that is where we think there's pharmaceutical trials in humans that might help break people of certain habits. And if we find that we can get animals that are contra-prepared when they are given this same treatment to be able to learn things that you wouldn't expect them to be able to learn, then maybe that teaches something about these vertebrate neural pathways and potential pharmaceutical interventions in humans later or something like that. So it's good to know about these three different options for training. So any questions about what I mean by prepared, unprepared, and contra-prepared? Not something I'm going to dwell on a lot. You might expect on a midterm or a final, maybe one question, very, you know, we would say low-level Bloom's taxonomy. It would be a more a definitional question. This is not something that I'm expecting a lot of higher order thought about. Okay. All right. So questions at all? You remember the star? Well, it's the exact same question with that star. So just to make sure everybody is remembers that, then I'll just open up the multiple choice. So same question from last time. Did you notice the star in the corner of the slides in lecture C1 just before the clicker exercises? Let's say you did, and let's say that every time you saw the star, you got your phone out early to answer, or your tablet out, or your computer out early to answer the clicker response before the clicker stimulus was even actually presented. So if you start to learn to do the clicker behavior before the normal clicker stimulus, then the claim is you've been classically conditioned. And if you've been classically conditioned by this star, then what do we view the star? Is the star the unconditioned stimulus, the unconditioned response, the conditioned stimulus, or the conditioned response? So go ahead and put in your clicker answers. It's the same question we ended lecture C1 with. So just as a review, let's see how things are doing. Almost got the whole class. It looks like most everybody is going with conditioned stimulus, and that's what we're looking for, is conditioned stimulus there. Because the unconditioned stimulus, that's this slide, the blue and the darker blue and the white, that's the stimulus that the natural response when you see the blue, the dark blue, and the white is to get out your clicker stuff. But then the new unconditioned stimulus, or the new conditioned stimulus, this new condition that was added, is that if you see the star in the upper left-hand corner, that is another reason to get out that behavior. So it's the conditioned stimulus and you responding to the star, that response is the conditioned response. Questions about that? Pretty clear? Okay, great. All right, so let's then apply these lessons to more complex examples. Again, my dog Dexter. So I like to use him for a lot of examples. Dexter will respond to cards. So I can show him sit and I can show him down, and he will. And I swear this is not a Clever Hans experiment. It's not like I'm twitching my nose a particular way. You know, he did learn, he does, you know, learn the cards. And so this, I would claim, this training exercise, which is a very simple dog training exercise, we have to view through the lenses of both operant and classical conditioning. So it's this idea that, and this is a little crude the way I put this here, but I need to get Dexter to do something that he doesn't normally do. So that is the operant. I need him to exhibit a sit. So I might just have to stare at him for a very long time and wait for him to sit. and he may never sit. So I have to catch him whenever he sits because he has no idea what I want. But if he sits, then I can potentially reinforce that behavior. So I can give him a reinforcer, and I can create then this increase in frequency of that behavior. So I can use reinforcement to get him to sit much more often than he normally would. And he does. He knows that this is one of the first things he learns. If he's not sure what I want, he sits. That's just what he does because it's a decent guess. But then once I have that, now I can associate lots of other conditions to that. And so I could get him to sit. There are other stimuli I was originally using to get him to sit, but I can pair them with new stimuli. And eventually he picks up that, oh, this is that thing I already learned with this one stimuli. I'm going to copy it to another stimuli so that eventually I can just show him cards and he'll sit for those cards without me using a hand signal or without me using the words. So I use one type of conditioning to increase the frequency of the behavior and another type of conditioning to copy that behavior onto other types of stimulus or stimuli. So I wouldn't say the dog training, that you'd use, like, and if you go to watch a YouTube video on dog training, I wouldn't say that it fits perfectly any one, classical, learning paradigm. It's probably a mixture of them. And so we use them as lenses to think about components of complex behaviors. So any questions about how I've broken this down? It's a little crude, but and I think a lot of animal training, applied animal behavior is this: reinforcement to get the behavior to be reproducible, and then transfer to different types of stimuli. All right, so that's one way, an example of using these basic models as lenses to think about complex behaviors. And sometimes when we do that, we find surprises and things that just don't fit any of the models that we know about. And that's often where interesting research lives. So, like I said, in behavioral genetics, whenever you find unexplained variants, that's usually where you find new research questions. Because what we do in science fundamentally is explaining unexplained variants. So I can give some examples that will lead to that. So here's taste aversion learning. This is a complex form of learning that looks a little bit like learning you've seen before, but doesn't quite fit. So what do we mean by taste aversion learning? So a bird will eat, let's say, a butterfly. And a butterfly that it's never eaten before. And it will get sick and it will lead to a negative reaction, vomiting, but it doesn't vomit immediately. So it might be you eat the butterfly now, tomorrow you vomit. You might have, on a college campus, there might be a particular substance that, you've maybe had an experience with that led to a bad experience hours or even a day later. And then it leads to a memory that says, I'm never going to drink that thing again. It's a similar sort of thing. And so it's in as little as one strongly negative reaction to ingesting a poisonous food with a characteristic taste, an animal learns to avoid that taste possibly for its entire life. My wife will not drink sangria, as an example. And so you look at this and it seems like it might fit imprinting because it's for the entire life, but it's not quite imprinting because it doesn't occur during a critical time. It can occur any time in life, and then it is lifelong after that. You also think it might be associative learning, but it's just too fast. The learning curves that you have for associative learning require several trials over and over until you get, and then you tend to forget it. So it's not usually for the rest of the of life. And then also, interestingly enough, this learning can occur even under anesthesia. So Gesundheit, you can knock this bird out. You can give it substances while it's unconscious. You can have it ingest substances that will then later cause it to vomit. And even though it was knocked out when it got that ingestion, then it still forms the memory. So this is a totally different learning circuit in the brain of many vertebrate animals, taste aversion learning. So it feels like learning we've heard about, but it just doesn't quite match. And because of that, people now study taste aversion learning separately and try to understand all the mechanisms of taste aversion learning, which are different than the mechanisms of general associative learning, which is, I think, pretty cool. And another example of that, vampire bats. Vampire bats do associative learning. You can bring them into the lab, you can teach them to do associative learning tasks like, you can find something with blue, but not with yellow, and they'll learn blue and so on. They'll do associative learning. But they do not do taste aversion learning. You can make them vomit all day long, and they will not pick up a bad taste for something. Why do you think that might be? Why do you think, ultimately speaking, from the ultimate causation, thinking about function or adaptation, why do we think taste aversion learning might not be useful for a vampire bat? Any thoughts? Yeah.
So if they were to develop taste aversion to blood, then that would be an aversion to like everything possible and could be their.
Yeah, well, in the blood they drink, do you think it's is it blood from a dead animal or a live animal? I would think most of these vampire bats, if you hear vampire bats, they're actually foraging on live animals, live blood. So, but yeah, the point you're making is excellent. That is a great hypothesis, is that their meals are fresh. I mean, they get it straight from the shop. They can go to the cow. This is a healthy cow. It's got blood that is being taken care of by the entire system of the cow. It's being filtered by the cow. The cow is producing high quality food for this little critter. And it's very, very rare for the blood that vampire bats drink to be poisoned in any way that could have negative consequences for the bat. So much so that taste aversion learning, if you accidentally get a taste aversion to blood, that's going to kill this poor bat because they are specialists on it, right? So taste aversion learning is actually too costly for these bats. So it is to their advantage, hypothetically, this is the hypothesis, but it is to their advantage to lose taste aversion learning. So it's my thought that taste aversion learning, I'm pretty sure, is more ancient than these bats, but along this branch of the tree of life, it's been lost because bats that drink from the blood, it's actually too costly to have taste aversion learning. You get so little benefit and you potentially have so much cost that that has been squashed. And so you don't get taste aversion learning in these bats. So I think that's kind of interesting, is that, but it shows here that taste aversion learning is a completely different circuit than associative learning. You can lose your taste aversion learning, but still have your associative learning. So that's kind of what we're saying here. Does anybody know about the cane toads in Australia? They're, these poisonous, invasive critters that there are a lot of the local wildlife tries to eat, and they get killed by them. And those critters, those little marsupials, the quolls or everything else that are out there that try to eat these cane toads do have taste aversion learning. But the cane toads kill them so quickly that they don't survive the next meal to use that taste aversion learning. So one of the things that they're trying to do is actually create less potent toxins that have the same taste as cane toads and distribute them in foods that are available to that for these wild animals to find. And what they're finding in these areas, when you allow taste aversion learning to be learned, so you actually provide them artificial, dummy foods that they encounter that cause them to throw up and survive, they're seeing a much greater survival whenever there are real cane toads around. So if you let them pick up the taste aversion learning, there are fitness benefits. And that, if they do happen to taste a little bit of that cane toad, they don't pursue it because they immediately get that, that taste aversion. They stay away from the cane toad. All right, questions about taste aversion learning. Seems kind of like associative learning, but it's a totally different circuit. Yeah. The vampire bats? The vampire bats don't have taste aversion learning because their natural foods are never poisoned. And so because of that, there's no benefit to it, there's only costs. That's the hypothesis. It's a strongly supported hypothesis, but you know, we talk about hypotheses. That is a functional hypothesis of why doesn't this critter have it? A mechanistic hypothesis would be to say, oh, when you look at their brain, it's missing this particular pathway. And then we'd say that explains the mechanism of where the taste aversion learning went. So different ways we can explain it. Any other questions? Great. Another example, trial and error learning. So Sellers J, great example of this. This is a very interesting bird that is well known for its ability to defeat campground devices, mean it can keep birds out. It will just try. It has, it'll try a variety of different things. It'll reshuffle and eventually it gets in. It's really good at it. It's also an aggressive predator on eggs of other birds. And so the thought is that it has these abilities to get into nests and avoid detection and avoid defenses that might be put up to keep it from getting into these eggs. And that also allows it to defeat human traps or human barriers that try to keep it out. And so this trial and error learning, it just basically, you watch it. It'll explore different strategies in order to see which one of them works. And then once that one works, then it will start doing that strategy over and over. So what type of learning do you think this is most like? So it's trying a bunch of things until it figures out one thing that works and then it does that thing over and over. What does that seem most like? You know, when we think about the types of learning we've learned about last time, the simple types of learning. Conditioned response operant conditioning in particular. So it's increasing the frequency of a behavior. So we would say, oh, it's trying a bunch of things. When it gets a winner, then it says, ah, now whenever I see that blue device, then I'm gonna cock my head to the left and move it up a certain way, and I'm gonna keep doing that, and then I can quickly get to that. And I just had to try a bunch of things in order to get there. So it finds the key to the lock. And then once it finds that key, it remembers that key and it just keeps going at it. So that's an example of so-called trial and error learning. When you see an animal that's shuffling through different things and finding one and then going with it. So it's right in the name, reinforcement, trial and error. I'm gonna try this. If it doesn't work, I'll try something else. If it doesn't work, eventually I find the thing that works. So that's one that those that operant conditioning actually fits pretty well with. Okay, more complex examples. So I mentioned the squirrels already. Cache retrieval, and I'm also going to talk about latent learning. And latent learning actually greatly relates to a technology that we're all now more familiar with, ChatGPT. So we'll get into that here in a second. But before that, squirrels talked about in, I think this is going to come up in your Unit C reading, they do what's called scatter hoarding. So they collect more food than they need, and they then store it elsewhere in the environment. So the contrast to that is larder hoarding, like honeybees, ants. So in that case, they store more than they immediately need and they bring it home, or they bring it to a central location and then they just store it in that central location. So the problem, the advantage of larder hoarding is you know where all your food is. You put it in the refrigerator, it's there. But as anybody who's shared a refrigerator in a break room knows, there's a problem with storing your food all in one place. It can get stolen. It can get pilfered by others. And so the key problem to storing your food in a single central location is defending it from someone else taking it from you. So so that's larder hoarding. Squirrels and many other animals do it very differently. So they then don't have to worry about defense so much, but they have to do worry about figuring out how to retrieve it. So it is possible their food will get stolen, but it's a little more cryptic because it's not all in one place. So they have to hide it in places that only they can find it again, which is not an easy task. But the key problem there is really them finding it again. It's not the, you know, like In the case of the honeybees, they don't have to find it. They know exactly where it is. They have to defend against it because everyone knows where it is. In the case of scatter hoarding, no one really knows where it is, and the key problem is finding it again. And so that opens up a lot of interesting research questions because squirrels do this and other things too. Gray jays, for example, speaking of jays, there are birds that do this as well. Lots of things cache, they scatter hoard. And that opens up these opportunities for behavior. So, the key question here is how do scatter hoarders retrieve items from their caches? What type of causal question is this how question? Would we call this a functional question, a phylogenetic or evolution question, an ontogenetic or a developmental question, or a mechanistic question? What do you think? Are we asking about how it works? Are we asking about its function? Are we asking about how it evolved over time? Are we asking about how it developed? Or are we asking about how it works? Mechanistic. How many people would say mechanistic? That's right. Yeah. So this is a great example of a mechanistic question. When you answer this question, you are not. So when you talk to, if you ever talk to reporters, everybody always wants to go function. And you have to, sometimes you kind of got to play with it. You have to say, well, okay, maybe there's this function or this function. But answers to this question, we are not saying why it's good to do any one of these. We're just saying, what do they do? And there are a couple of options. So one of them is a reforaging hypothesis. So a squirrel hides its nut somewhere. One of the hypotheses, the kind of null hypothesis, is how does it find the nuts again? Maybe it just reforages for them. Maybe it has no idea where those nuts are, and so it just goes and searches again, but in the hopes that it scattered them around, maybe closer to them, maybe in an easier place to find, but there's no memory. There's nothing really intelligent going on there. It's just finding them again. Like, oh, I found a nut near a tree. I'm going to bury it. And so then now I have to also dig and then I'll refind it. So that's kind of the, when there's retrieval is necessary, animal searches again without prior knowledge or cues. It just searches again. An alternative hypothesis is searching by rule. So what we mean by that is it buries it near environmental cues that help it find it later. Like, oh, I found a nut here out in the open by this tree. I'm going to pick it up and I'm going to bury it under a shrub that has red berries on it. And so now when I need to come back, find the red berries and then start digging. And that's going to be likely, if I stored it anywhere, that's where I'll store it. So you have a cue in the environment and you correlate your storage to that cue. That's the searching by rule hypothesis. And then the third one for us to consider is the learned cache retrieval hypothesis, where the animal buries it somewhere and then learns, and it might be using cues in the environment, but it's not a general rule. It's like, okay, these nuts I buried right here, and I remember there's this type of desk and this type of desk, but these other nuts I buried here, and I remember there's a fire extinguisher nearby. So it's actually, you're engaging neuroplasticity. The animal has to learn for anywhere where it's stored. And so we're saying that this is an example of the use of so-called episodic memory, memory associated with a specific experience. So it's not associated with a general cue. It's like, oh, I remember at that time I buried them by the fire extinguisher. That's an episodic memory. It remembers an episode of the animal's life. Those are three hypotheses we would like to test. And that reading that you're going to read about is going to try to test some of these in squirrels. Questions about these three hypotheses? So only this one engages learning. And you can think of it as sort of a very complex version of associative learning, where you are associating a new set of cues or experiences with that reward of those nuts. So it's, again, it's not doesn't quite fit, but you can definitely see that if you tested associative learning, you're probably also going to get at capabilities of the squirrels to do this learned cache retrieval. Okay, so three hypotheses. We're not saying which one's better. Under some environments, this is going to be better. Under other environments, this will be better. Under this and other environments, this will be better. We can't say uniformly which one's better. There's just sometimes one and sometimes the other. There are costs and benefits to each, but we are not commenting on the costs and benefits. We are just asking for this squirrel, what does it do? And we can then test to see what it does or what's most consistent with what it does. Okay, so, but we have a similar problem is that who's stealing the food? How will they find the food that is so hidden? And they have a similar set of hypotheses. They can also just search for caches. They can search for cues that are often associated with caches, or they can observe the storage from stores that are out there. And this happens. You'll actually watch animals. This happens like birds and squirrels. You might actually have a bird that's watching a squirrel. And when the squirrel buries, so this will often be with corvids, like ravens and crows, things like that. These are very smart birds, and they can watch a squirrel dig and then bury these nuts. And when the squirrel goes away, sometime later, the bird can come back to that location when the squirrel is away and dig them up. So that is a very complex learning behavior. You have to watch another animal. I'm not trying to say it's that cognitive, but that you have to, this has been selected for at least to pay attention to a squirrel, remember where the squirrel has buried these things, and then come back later when the squirrel's not around. And so that is, again, a complex learning behavior here. And all three of these things, you know, have a shot at being true. And for some pilferers, you're going to find that one of them's more true than others. And for other pilferers, it'll go the other way around. I can't say that one is always better. There are benefits and costs. Any questions about these three hypotheses, mechanistic hypotheses for how pilferers steal from caches? There's three different ways that you can observe. Some animals will do one, some animals do the other, but these cover a lot of the strategies that are used in pilferers. Okay, so it's interesting here that animals that use observational learning and also steal from conspecifics will behave differently when under observation. So there have been studies that have been done where if you have an animal that both is observed to sometimes, we sometimes produce, that means find the food, and sometimes scrounge, that means steal the food. If there's an animal that in that species, they do both, and there are a lot of animals that do that, they steal from conspecifics, then those animals, if you put them in a laboratory setup where you put a conspecific behind a plastic barrier so you can see the other animal, the storage behavior of the animal in the arena changes relative to whether there's nothing in that. And so the an animal that uses observational learning that does both of these things will often rebury, like it will bury its in the lab. If you give it a little dirt, it'll bury its nuts, and then it will go over a few minutes later and it will take them out and then rebury them, and then take them out and rebury them, and then take them out and rebury them again. And it will do that, but then if you take the observer away, it will just bury them once. Why do you think that might be? Why might having an observer that is of your species watching you cause you to rebury your food over and over again? When you don't have the observer, you don't. Yeah. Yeah, so how would that prevent them from stealing? Why would that be better? Right, it's just, it's a harder learning task. It's a lot harder when, if the observer is watching, they're forcing the observer to keep track. It's a lot like having those, you know, cups that you're moving around to try to say, like, you know, is the ball under one cup or the other? And you're constantly shuffling those around. It's the same sort of thing. And so this is these types of studies are some of the studies that suggest that certain animals are cognitive and that they have a sort of theory of mind, that they are able to anticipate that if I make this easy to find, then another animal is likely to come back and steal these. And so when I see another animal, knowing that that animal is probably trying to steal from me, I'm going to be extra defensive. And so that is one way people talk about theory of mind, which is something we'll get into in the next lecture. But that's an example there. Any questions about these things, about pilferers and their relationship to hoarders? Okay, great. All right, so another example, classic example, Tolman's rats, which you might have heard about if you take a psych class. Tolman has a lot of foundations in psychology. The idea here, it's an old experiment. You take rats and then you put them in a maze. So this is just a chalk drawing of a maze, but it turned out Tolman used a bunch of these T mazes and junctions and things. And you can measure how often the rats go into dead ends, like turn into dead ends, and those are kind of failures, or go to live ends in the maze. Now you can record, so this experiment runs for, let's say, 22 days, and there's three different groups of rats. There's a group of rats that has never provided cheese at the maze. So then you can see how quickly do those rats learn to run the maze without making dead ends. Then there's another group that is not given cheese until after the 11th day. And so they have no cheese for the first 10, 11 days, and then they get cheese after the 11th day. And then you have another group that is given cheese the whole time. Any guesses here as to which rat learns the maze most quickly? How many people think this rat learns the maze very quickly? How many people think this rat learns the maze very quickly? How many people think this rat learns the maze very quickly? So most people are saying that this rat here learns the maze the fastest. That, I think, is what Tolman might have thought too. Turns out that's not the case. So let's look at some data from this. So these are real data here, and I'll annotate them to make it easier to read here. So this first one here, what we see on the y-axis, these are the number of blind alleys, errors in a maze. So these were T-maze junctions. So a rat would hit one of these T-junctions and it could either turn down the blind alley or turn down the live alley. And you can measure, you know, so initially all rats in all three groups in a given maze, they would, they'd all make the same number of errors. And so as these lines decrease, you're seeing them learn the maze. So if you don't give them any cheese ever, then they do eventually learn to get through the maze with less errors. But if you give them cheese the whole time, they learn faster. And so that's what we see here. They are learning to make less errors. But the interesting thing that Tolman found is if you mix those so that for the first 11 days, you don't give them any cheese, they look just like the no cheese ever group. But on the 11th day, when you give them cheese, then suddenly they can find their way out of the maze faster than the ones that have cheese the whole time. So this third group here apparently was in the background learning the maze, but you couldn't observe that learning until after you gave it reinforcement. So this was this is what Tolman viewed was unreinforced learning up to day 11 that was then revealed after reinforcement. And this is something that Tolman called latent learning. So learning without reinforcement that could then be used later when reinforcement was added. So-called latent learning. So everybody get this before we move on, and we're not gonna move, we're still gonna talk about latent learning, but and we'll define latent learning on the next slide, but I wanna make sure we understand this graph, is that the thought here is that this treatment group is actually, and you know, arguably probably this treatment group too, is learning the maze, but it's just, it doesn't have any reinforcement to show off what it's learning, and then when you finally give it reinforcement, then you see that come up. So it's almost learning general properties, and then you give it the reinforcement, and then it somehow is an even better learner than if you just gave it the, have it specialize on cheese to begin with. Is that clear? So it's a weird result. No cheese plus cheese is the fastest learning. And so we call this latent learning, learning that is acquired in the absence of immediate reinforcement. It's not observably manifested until a specific need exists later. And Tolman coined the term in a later paper, cognitive map. He was saying that what was the rats learning? The rats were learning a cognitive map. They were In Tolman's hypothesis, the rats were actually learning spatial relationships. They were learning this map in their brains, even though they didn't know what to do with it. They were just late learning, just happened to learning that, okay, if I walk this far, I turn right, that's a blind alley, I'll turn left. So, you know, I wanna go left, 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 right, right. That's how I make it through this maze. And they had no reinforcement, they just happened to learn the map. So then when you then ask them about the map, so you give them a cheese and say, hey, can you find this cheese? Then they say, oh yeah, I actually have this map and I can use this map to find the cheese even faster. That's so-called latent learning. Now, since then, behaviorists have provided other explanations for how you can get the result that I just showed you without forming a cognitive map in your head, but it still is a reasonable and interesting hypothesis to consider. Any questions about these definitions? And we're going to talk more about this next time when we talk about cognition as well, because Tolman was a big part of some of the early groundwork for cognition and comparative psychology. Now, I mentioned that this links current events. There is, you know, so, you know, GPT, ChatGPT, GPT stands for generatives, which means it generates language, pre-trained transformer. Well, that pre-trained, what is that? That is a form of latent learning. And so, the computer scientists have this thing called self-supervised learning, where normally the way you train machines to do things is you tell them what's right and what's wrong, and you use kind of a form of classical conditioning to get them to, whenever they make the right answer to a given input, you then you move that to the input you want them to give that answer. So that's normally how you do things. But these latest machine learning algorithms, these GPTs, use something that is inspired by latent learning called self-supervised learning, where they gave, so ChatGPT was never given a training set where it could say, like, for this input, like if you say, do my homework, and it, like, you know, and it pops out a homework, it was never given that. ChatGPT was given just books and books and books. And then it will, during its pre-training, just grab words out of the books, black them out, and then try to predict those words based on the words around it. And it just autonomously decides what things to black out, what words to replace, to see if it can find those. It basically wanders around in a maze and over time learns patterns of language. And then later on, you then say, do my homework, and it says homework. That is a novel thing, just like presenting cheese to the rat. It has learned patterns in the maze, and now that you've presented the cheese, it can find its way through. So that is now a computer-based version of this idea that was first studied by Tolman in the 30s. So that's what the P in pre-trained, that's what pre-trained means, latent learning from an artificial perspective. So that's what that's about. Any questions about latent learning? Let me wrap up our last couple of examples here. Okay. All right, so now getting back to the what I opened the opening slide with, social learning. So right now we've talked about the individuals not really learning from each other, except for maybe the pilferer learning from the hoarder about where to find the cash. So social learning, there's some great examples of this. This is one example of migratory behavior and whooping cranes. This is sort of a famous story of this population of whooping cranes that got kind of alienated from. So the way whooping cranes learn migratory routes is by following a parent, and the parent will fly that migratory route. And then after it flies that route, then the offspring will know that route, and then they can migrate back and forth. And so there's the history of this is complex. And I think I've got a link on this slide if you want to read more about it. But essentially, they were trying to establish a population of these whooping cranes in an area where they weren't, where they had been lost from, and they needed the ability to teach these migratory routes. And so what they were able to do is get these whooping cranes to imprint on a scientist that dressed up in a white outfit with kind of a whooping crane sort of beak on. And that scientist could fly in this ultralight glider and they would follow them. And you could actually then, this thing doesn't have a lot of fuel, so it would have to, this is like going from, I think, Michigan to Florida. So they would do these little hops, and the cranes would just follow it the whole time, and they'd stop and refuel, and they'd do this again, and you could follow this ultralight glider across this large route, and then the cranes learn the route, and the human then wasn't needed after that. And so this is an example of route learning through a social connection here across species. So that is, this observational learning allows you to not only learn things about your environment, but to learn things from others about your environment, which I think is pretty interesting. And, that's where it brings me to this example that I started with in the title slide. These are Timnothorax. I think these are albopinus, but there's basically a tiny ant that lives in acorns or rock crevices. They do not lay pheromone trails. We'll talk about pheromones in a later lecture, but do this behavior though. So this ant up front, this leader, she has found a new nest, and she is not sure if this nest is a good quality nest, and so she wants to bring another recruit over. I'm adding a lot of she wants. Please excuse that, but the idea here is that you need another recruit to assess that nest. This one in the back does not know where this new nest is. So this one will step a few steps and wait for this one in the back to touch her on the rear end. Notice the one in the back is swinging her head around a lot more than the one on the front. Other experiments have demonstrated that it appears like this one in the back is visually encoding the landscape. So she is touches the one on the front when she's ready for her next little information. They walk a few steps, she looks around, she says, okay, everything's there. All right, I'm ready, a touch, and then you get the next couple of steps. So these two will walk this whole way back to the new nest. And when they get there, kind of like those whooping cranes, then the one in the leader will walk back to the old nest and do it again. And this one will stay at the new nest, check it out, decide whether she likes it, and then she'll come back on her own. And so this is the only way they can learn the routes to the nest. You might have noticed streaming by here other ants being carried. And that's something that I'm not going to go into, but that's another way you can get ants from one place to another. You just pick an ant up and carry her to a new location. Ants that are carried do not learn the routes. This is the way they learn the routes. So this is another way of two animals communicating a piece of information to each other, a route by following each other. So social learning. You could come up with a story, of learning models that seem to fit the best here. We can say, is this associative learning? Is this operant conditioning? Is this classical conditioning? And so on. None of them are going to fit perfectly, but elements of them are certainly going to help us, again, use as a lens to look into this behavior and say, what are some core components here? Is there reinforcement? Is there not? What are the cues? What are the, how far apart are cues and rewards if there are those? A lot of interesting questions which come up when we observe this behavior, looking through those lenses of those classical models. All right, questions about tandem running? That's what we call this, tandem running in ants. A lot of ants do this. Instead of using trails, they use tandem running. Okay, so that's my basic message. We have these three basic models. They're not perfect. They're not meant to explain all learning that's in nature, but they are useful tools to help focus our attention on the key problems and potential solutions so that we can better understand complex learning phenomena that we see in nature. So they also help us suggest simple designs for meaningful laboratory experiments. So maybe we see something that is associative learning adjacent. Well, then we might be able to set up a simple laboratory experiment that is, a classical conditioning experiment. And we can infer that performance at that laboratory experiment is ecologically relevant because we can make the claim that you need aspects of that classical conditioning in the complex task that's in nature. So that helps keep things relevant. And, learning in life is complex and will not always have a good fit for the models. We're not using the models to explain all of what's going on in life, we're using the models to help guide our explorations of learning. That's the key here. So it's okay if you don't think these fit, you know, your experience with animal learning. They're not supposed to. They're supposed to help guide our explorations. Okay, so you know, the next step in that will be then to make, so these are kind of the simple, these are the simple tools of behaviorism up here. So in the next lecture, we now start thinking about cognition. What happens when we start assuming that an animal has an internal mental world? And we're now start saying hypotheses where the best explanation for some of the behaviors we see is not that the animal is behaving purely in response to the external world, but is behaving in response to not only the external world, but its internal state. That is effectively cognition. And that's what we'll talk about next time. All right, so any questions? All right, with that then let's wrap up with this last clicker. Question here, what type of food caching behavior involves distributing stored food all throughout the home range, as opposed to storing it just in their local home? So it's all throughout the environment. Is it larder hoarding, scatter hoarding, central place foraging, or pilfering? And that's all I've got for you. So we'll see you next time. Feel free to come up if you have questions.